ॐ ज्ञानतिमिरन्नस्य ज्ञानञ्जनाशलाकाय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः।
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय नारायणं नमस्कृत्य नरं चैव नरोत्तमं देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासम् ततो जयमुदीरये। Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 7, The Son of Drona Punished. Today's verse is number 6. Anarto Pashunam Sakshat Bhakti Yogam Adhokshaje Lokasya Janato Vidvansh Chakre Sattvata Samhitam Anarto Pashunam Sakshad Bhakti Yogam Adhokshaje Lokasya Janato Vidvansh Chakre Sattvata Samhitam Anarto Pashunam Sakshad Bhakti Yoga Madhokshaje Janato Vidvansh Chakre Sattvata Samhitam Anarto Pashamam Shakshad Bhakti Yoga Madhokshaje Vaishnavis Anarto Pashanam Sakshad Bhakti Yoga Madhokshaje Janato Vidvansh Chakri Sattvata Samhitam or Ake Moichi Do Anarto Pashanam Sakshad Bhakti Yoga Madhokshaje Lokasya Janato Vidvansh Chakri Sattvata Samhitam Anarta. Things which are superfluous. Upashanam. Mitigation. Sakshat. Directly. Bhakti Yogam, the linking process of devotional service. Adhokshaje, unto the transcendence. Lokasya, of the general mass of men. Janataha, those who are unaware of. Vidvan, the supremely learned. Chakre, compiled sattvata in relation with the Supreme Truth. Samhitam, Vedic literature. Translation, the material miseries of the living entity, which are superfluous to him, can be directly mitigated by the linking process of devotional service. But the mass of people do not know this, and therefore the learned Vyasadeva compiled this Vedic literature, which is in relation to the Supreme Truth. Please repeat. The material miseries of the living entity, which are superfluous to him, can be directly mitigated by the linking process of devotional service. But the mass of people do not know this, and therefore the learned Vyasadeva compiled this Vedic literature, which is in relation to the Supreme Truth. Purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. Srila Vyasadeva saw the all-perfect personality of Godhead. This statement suggests that the complete unit of the personality of Godhead includes His parts and parcels also. He saw, therefore, His different energies, namely the internal energy, the marginal energy, and the external energy. He also saw His different plenary portions, and parts of the plenary portions, namely his different incarnations also. And he specifically observed the unwanted miseries of the conditioned souls who are bewildered by the external energy. And at last he saw the remedial measure for the conditioned souls, namely the process of devotional service. This is a great transcendental science. It is a great transcendental science and begins with the process of hearing and chanting the name, fame, glories, etc. of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Revival of the dormant affection or love of Godhead does not depend on the mechanical system of hearing and chanting, but it solely and wholly depends on the causeless mercy of the Lord. When the Lord is fully satisfied with the sincere efforts of the devotee, he may endow him with his loving transcendental service. But even with the prescribed forms of hearing and chanting, there is at once mitigation of the superfluous and unwanted miseries of material existence. Such mitigation of material affection does not wait for development of transcendental knowledge. Rather, knowledge is dependent on devotional service for the ultimate realization of the supreme truth. Just an observation, not in the Bhagavatam class, but just as far as organizational management goes, in thinking about a temple room as an oasis and a place for people to come together here and chant, what can be a fruitful, helpful, and enlivening exercise is to come together and brainstorm the ways in which to cater to those who come into the environment who don't know what's going on. Some people already know what's going on and they sort of follow along. But if you consider it, like, what's it like to be a brand new person who just walked into this environment, and perhaps they don't know what kind of prayers we're saying, or they have no idea what an artik is or anything, it's best not to assume anything, because it's easy for those who have been practicing for some time to then think that, oh, I know it, so everyone else probably does too. Or worse, like, I know it, so I don't care if anybody else knows. Of course, that's rarely the case. But it's more a matter of sort of reverse engineering and going back and seeing what would it be like if I walked in the first time and how much information is available in this environment so that I can follow along and feel like part of the program. And I guarantee you, if you go out of your way to reconstruct the environment in such a way that a person who walked in for their first time would be able to discern everything that's going on and also feel welcome and be able to participate in every part of it and understand what the rituals meant, that it increases the environment for everybody. In fact, oftentimes, even those who have been participating for a long time really don't know what's going on either. Although they say Hari Bol, if you can say Hari Bol, everyone say Hari Bol. Then you just assume everybody knows everything. If you can say Hari Bol, it's like, oh yeah, right, okay, fine, you're good. You don't need anything else. So in this verse, which is in a section of very important verses that have been commented on by Jiva Goswami in the Tattva Sandarbha, today's verse is especially enlivening because he's giving the remedy. Of course, we heard yesterday about the plight of the living entity in the material world as being victimized practically by the illusory material energy. And of course, those who are not in abject illusion realize that they are being subjected to the lower energies of the material world. But then, how to get out of that? Oftentimes people can give lots of commentary about what's wrong with the world or any particular situation, but when it comes to giving an actual remedy, they come up short. But the Bhagavatam doesn't come up short. It tells us what the problem is, and then it tells what the solution is. This is actually a staple in marketing. They tell you what your problem is and where you hurt, and then they tell you how to fix it. That's very compelling, because everyone's suffering, and the main endeavor that I make in this world is to try to make the suffering go away. So here's the verse. Anartopasanam Shakshat Bhakti Yogam Adhoksije Lokasya Ajanato Vidvams Chakre Sarvata Samhitam. The Lord again comes to our rescue. And this is his preoccupation. He's always thinking, say the prayers of personified Vedas, and they also comment that this is his greatest of all his leelas, is to save the conditioned souls. And everybody likes this kind of thing. When we see a play or a drama, and then the downtrodden get saved by the hero, then this becomes very heartening and glorious. And so similarly here, we're finding that the living entities are drowning in the material ocean, and the Lord's coming to save them. And very particularly in this verse, the way in which Krishna comes to us to save us is in the form of his literary incarnation, Śrīla Vyāsadeva. So it says that the Lord knows that this is the problem, and that's why Vyāsadeva compiled this Vedic literature. He did it deliberately. He knew exactly what was going on and what the remedy is, and then he organized the project. It takes a lot of work to organize projects, especially literary ones, because you have to think very carefully about how to compile the literature in such a way that people will be able to read it, and then you have to make sure you distribute it to the masses. So in this verse we find that we have an insight into the desire of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. First of all, that his desire is to give us relief and save us from the material world. And the second is that he does it in very practical ways, especially through compiling literature. Human beings match up with literature well. That's one of the abilities of human beings, not just abilities, but one of the great propensities of living beings is to consume information. And we see from time immemorial, they've been doing it in writing. Our bodies and minds are designed to take in information in the written form, especially for thousands of years, and in all cultures around the world. So Śrīla Vyāsadeva comes and compiles the Srimad Bhagavatam, just for this purpose, to make it available to everybody in the world. So in this purport, Prabhupada says that Śrīla Vyāsadeva saw the all-perfect personality of Godhead. And then he goes on to say that if one sees the personality of Godhead, it doesn't mean he sees him alone. He sees the Supreme Personality of Godhead with all of his energies, which include the living entity, the external energy, and all his various expansions, his shaktis. If you read in the very beginning of the Sri Brahma Samhita, there's an in-depth discussion of the way in which Radha and Krishna are situated as the center of the spiritual world, and emanating outwardly from that whorl of a lotus petal, there are the various energies of the Lord, including his various shaktis. And then on the outside, there are protective forces that don't allow those who are impure to enter within the spiritual world. And then there's the external energy for those who have misused their independence. So when one speaks of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then that it's automatically assumed that it means the Supreme Personality of Godhead and his energies. Just as when one speaks of the king, one never thinks of the king alone. After all, what's a king without subjects? There is no meaning to that. It's a relative term. And the king comes along with his subjects and his various servants and energies. He has energy. He's a ruler. He controls properties and wealth and so forth. In a similar way, Jiva Goswami points out that when you talk about the moon, you all also understand that the moon has there's moonlight that comes from the moon. There's the moon and there's the shining rays of the moon as well. So this is an important philosophical principle. And that is that when we say Krishna, We don't mean Krishna alone. We mean Krishna and his energies. There's the energy and the energetic. And his energies, Jiva Goswami says, are inconceivable. That means he can do anything with his energies and does do anything and everything with his energies. And this is actually the meaning of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, that he has unlimited shaktis or energies. And there's great implication in that philosophical point, because we're part of his energies and we also have a relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead as one of his energies. And that gives an inkling into the goal of life, which is suggested in the Vedas, and that is to reestablish our relationship with Krishna. So now Prabhupada further down in the purport says, after seeing the Lord in all his energies, he at last saw the remedial measure for the conditioned souls, namely the process of devotional service. It is a great transcendental science and begins with the process of hearing and chanting the name, fame, glory, etc. of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And so this is the remedy. Even the word remedy is promising. If you're sick and suffering and someone tells you, and they will, that they have a remedy for you, because everyone has a remedy for everything, it's good news. When we get it from Bhagavatam that there's an actual remedy to our diseased condition in the material world, then it's quite optimistic. When we hear it from everybody we meet on the street, like when you have a cold or any other kind of ailment, everyone will tell you that they know how to fix it. Everybody's a doctor. But Krishna really knows how to cure things and gives the direct remedy. So if one is ailing and goes to a professional and has great trust and knows in that person and knows the credentials of the person and then receives a packet of powder, whatever it is, that's going to cure, then it's quite an exciting prospect to have that in hand. So similarly, to come across this verse and then to find out what it means, and that is that there's a remedial process for overcoming all the anartas or the anomalies that I've come in contact with that are troubling me and have been troubling me since the time immemorial. The remedy is there. And if you simply take the remedy, then you'll gradually become cured of the disease. And this is the beginning of devotional service, which means vaidhi bhakti. So when you first have a disease and you go to the doctor and he or she gives you the medicine, then you take it and you may not feel immediate relief. And after a few days, you're taking the medicine and you're doing it out of faith. That I trust the doctor, I trust the source, I trust that was a real diploma on her roll that said she went to medical school. And you keep taking, and maybe you don't feel anything, but you're doing it out of duty. But maybe after the fourth or fifth day, then you start to suddenly feel some difference. It's hard to discern at first. You may think, I'm not sure if I'm actually getting better or not. But then, on the sixth day, you say, oh, I'm definitely better. And everyone starts to look at you and say, yes, I see you look better. I can, and then you can understand that the medicine is working. So there are different phases in devotional service. But Prabhupada points out here near the end of the purport, but he says, but even with the prescribed forms of hearing and chanting, there is at once mitigation of the superfluous and unwanted miseries of material existence. So this medicine is so effective that, as described by Rupa Goswami in his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, as soon as one approaches the medicine, in fact, there's a description of this even in the Srimad Bhagavatam, that the process of devotional service there is compared to a boat. that can take you across the ocean of material existence. Can I have that pillow back? I need it behind my back. And as soon as you decide that you're going to get on the boat and you approach it, you don't even have to get in the boat, but just by approaching it, then the ocean of material existence shrinks. And you're able to step over it, just as you would step over the water contained within the hoofprint of a calf. So in a similar way, as one comes to embrace the process of devotional service, accept it as the actual remedy, and with determination takes it up, in the very beginning, Rupa Goswami says that there is relief. And Prabhupada again indicates, I'll read again, he says, but even with the prescribed forms of union chanting, there is at once mitigation of the superfluous and unwanted miseries of material existence. So there are six symptoms of pure devotional service when one approaches the process. Rupa Goswami says, the first is that one immediately is relieved of material distress. And how is this possible? Well, the Srimad Bhagavatam and other shastras explain that as soon as you take to the process of devotional service, even at the outset, the karma that you've accumulated over many, many years due to a contact with the material nature is eradicated. And therefore, there's a relief from the suffering condition of material existence. Rupa Goswami in his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, to verify this, quotes from the Padma Purana, in which he says, aprarabdha palam papam kutam bijam palomukam krame naiva priliyante vishnu bhakti ratatmanam. In this verse he describes that the each living entity is contending with a variety of karmic reactions. And some of them are very subtle, and some of them have manifested as the gross body that I now have in this lifetime. And by the way, as soon as you get the gross material body, you're going to get a certain amount of happiness and a certain amount of distress. That's already worked out. That's what it means, prarabdha karma. That you get what you get. So the Bhagavatam or this verse says, in whatever stage the karma is, aprarabdha means that it's not manifest yet; it's waiting for you. Isn't that exciting? There's not enough room in this short little lifetime to experience all the karmic reactions that have piled up from previous lifetimes. You have to get one of those extra storage lockers that they have here in Denver. They're so popular. And to keep all that extra karma, and it's waiting for you next life. It'll go on forever. There's no end to it. But that, by the process, Vishnu Bhakti Ratatmanam, by performing Vishnu Bhakti, then that karmic reaction is mitigated. It's destroyed. That's why one feels relief as soon as one takes the process of devotional service, even as a neophyte in the very beginning. One approaches the process of devotional service, begins to hear and chant the association of devotees, and one feels a relief from material distress. And this is the first symptom when one first takes the devotional service, and the other is auspiciousness. Rupa Goswami says that when one takes the process of devotional service, one's auspicious life begins. Auspiciousness he defines as that one has the wherewithal to do good for all other living beings. This is a great asset. And not only are you becoming freed from the influence of material karma, but also now you have the wherewithal to do good for others. And therefore your life becomes auspicious. And so with these, Rupa Goswami says that just like a little plant when it pokes its head out from the soil. Those two beginner leaves are very different from the other leaves, and they have a rough surface and a shiny surface, if you notice a little plant that pokes its head up. So he compares this to the very beginning of devotional service, and that even at the outset, when experiences relief from the onslaught of material distress, and also the birth of auspiciousness in one's life. And this is like the sprouting of these leaves. So Prabhupada finishes his purport by saying, such mitigation of material affection does not wait for development of transcendental knowledge. Rather, knowledge is dependent on devotional service for the ultimate realization of the Supreme Truth. And this is echoed in the first canto, second chapter of the Bhagavatam, Vasudeva Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Prayojita Janaya Yashavairagyam Jnanam Chayara Haitukam. That when one takes to the direct process of devotional service by hearing and chanting, one gets knowledge and detachment as concomitant results. And this is necessary, says the Bhagavatam, in order to move forward in with determination in devotional service. Same chapter that I just quoted from, Tachchadadhana Munayo Jnana Vairagya Yuktaya Pashyantya Atmani Chatmanam Bhaktya Shuta Grihitaya. This says that one must be fortified with knowledge and detachment in order to move steadily on the path of devotional service. And that comes naturally from the process of hearing chanting. So one conclusion we can draw from this verse today is that Srila Vyasadeva deliberately delivered the Srimad Bhagavatam to us so that we could take to the process of hearing and chanting and thus overcome the limiting aspects of material nature and come to our original position as servitors of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and become happy in this lifetime, make others happy, and then have the mitigation of material existence altogether by going back home, back to Godhead in this lifetime. And all this is possible by the mercy of the Lord who has manifested the Srimad Bhagavatam. That's why it's the center focus of our entire movement. That is hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, reading Srimad Bhagavatam, and distributing Srimad Bhagavatam to the masses of people. There's about 7 billion people in the world, so better get cracking. Now we'll take some reflections or questions. Yes, Shamyapras.
Hare Krishna, thank you very much. I was appreciating this point that you were bringing up from the purport that the hearing and chanting is the prime process and all the other things like knowledge and renunciation come from that. I have a question. So we see, for example, in your community of Silicon Valley that hearing and chanting is practically an addiction for the devotees. They're very much attracted to hearing and chanting. They're always looking forward to opportunities to get together and hear about Krishna. And I've noticed in myself and maybe in others too that while there may be an attraction to hearing and chanting on one's own, it seems like there are certain obstacles to getting people together and buying into, you know, hearing the Bhagavatam together, hearing different shastra and talking about it, at least at the beginning, before the taste really becomes full-blown. Can you talk a little bit about how to get from the point of, okay, having some faith in shastra to really buying into this whole getting together and talking about Krishna and glorifying together and exploring the shastra?
Well, it's more fun to get together. I know whenever I'm in a kirtan with Bhakti Marg Swami, it's twice as fun as when I'm in any other kirtan. And the reason is he brings everybody together. That's what he does in life. He brings people together. So you all know Bhakti Marg Swami, right? If you get in a kirtan with him, he makes eye contact with everybody in the kirtan, and then he like sort of orchestrates everyone's dancing. So they all start dancing together. He doesn't tolerate well people off in the corner dancing by themselves even. But he'll bring them in. Get in here, you know, dance. And this is one of the great arts of being a Goshti Nandi, is to learn the art of bringing people together. And that goes for not just kirtan, but also for prasadam, for book distribution, for hearing and chanting. So one thing you can bet your bottom dollar, and that is that that living entities like to have fun. They don't adhere well to rules and regulations. You just say what the rules are, and they'll follow them for a few days, and after a while, they'll go off and make up their own rules. That's what little jivas do. But if you say, little jiva, this is fun, and you make it fun, then you don't have to have any rules and regulations. Little jiva just comes in and says, yeah, this is what I do. I have fun. And they don't have to admit that they're following any process, because they don't like that. They're individuals, and they like to... They more like... Little jiva likes to say, like, I'm free. I do whatever I want. So you have to make things fun for the jiva. And if you concentrate on that rather than any kind of formulaic process or any rules and regulations to get everyone together, I'm not against rules and regulations. You can't have an organization without it. You have to have some... that sense also that there's actually somebody in charge here. Otherwise, jiva really flies around. And they just all start their own processes and organizations and start making stuff up on their own. So make it fun and make it obvious that it's fun and think of ways to find out the science of what makes it fun for people. People like to be recognized, that's one thing. They like to be consciously acknowledged. They like to participate sometimes. They also like good food. That's one thing. Any living entity, even animals, you advertise in the neighborhood, hey, there's good food over here. We were just in Japan, and at Jayashree's house and Ananta Goroma's house, they have an apartment on the fifth floor near the Tokyo Temple. So there's a balcony outside. And there's a few birds that come. They have a little wristwatch on. They know when to come. And they stop in and get biscuits out on the balcony. They make, come here, and they bring out their biscuits and they feed them. So if you feed people, they're likely to come back. And animals, too. They come back at the same time. Nirkula?
I think at ISV, you over time have developed that culture, and the classes that are held in the temple are very interactive, so the devotees are brought into the class on a regular basis. And then the other thing that we do, especially leading up to festival days, is we'll pick Ramayana, Krishna book, pastimes of Lord Nrsimhadev, and we do phone calls. And devotees take turns reading the Shastra and the stories. And it's done usually at 7:30 or 8 o'clock at night. The kids are in bed, everybody's been fed, and the devotees can just join the call. And then you're kind of giving everybody a bedtime story. So devotees develop a taste like that. And then at the end of the reading, they're invited to share their realizations and reflections. So that might be a way to start something.
One, two, three.
Which one?
Raise your hand.
Thank you very much for class, Maharaj. This word came through and I was in Seva, but inconceivable, and it struck a chord with me because I've been reading a book by Stephen Rosen. I don't know his devotee name, but he's on the Back to Godhead magazine editorial board and has written numerous novels, and it's, I think, called Christ and Krishna. And he speaks about, or the way he sets it up, it's a Swami Maharaj and from a Gaudiya Vaishnav tradition, and Frank, who is, they were good friends as children, and Frank became a Catholic, I don't want to use the wrong word, but very high up, kind of a monk-like character, and they came and sat down, and they discussed this inconceivable potency. So if we're developing love for someone, for a beloved, there's a certain amount of wanting to know more about them, who they are, where they came from, and then the more the relationship develops, the more you want to kind of uncover more of their background. And so the inconceivable potency is interesting because in Shastra it says that we learn or we understand Krishna by devotional service. Is there an element of, will we ever fully understand, or will it always be inconceivable? And do we really need to fully understand Krishna to be absolutely in love with him?
Krishna will always remain inconceivable, and there's a time at which when devotees become more intimately connected with Krishna out of preeti or loving sentiment, that they're no longer so much interested in his inconceivable nature, but they're just fascinated with him. For instance, yesterday we were reading the Nectar Devotion. It described how Krishna is a pleasing talker. And there's a description there when Krishna was a little boy, he used to say all kinds of things around the village, and everyone would become fascinated by hearing what he had to say. When any little boy or girl starts talking and speaking philosophy, everyone's like, "What'd you say?" But Krishna's masterful at that, even when he's a child, so people listen in and they become fascinated by him. And one of the underlying features of the spiritual world is wonderment. And this, Rupa Goswami says in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, is that Krishna is always more beautiful and more fascinating than he was the last time that one saw him. And it's not because you're just seeing him in a different light, but it's actually because he's becoming more beautiful and more fascinating and charming and so forth. So in Vrindavan, the devotees' entire lives rotate around Krishna. They're always talking about him, thinking about him, and they're just fascinated with him. And even when he performs pastimes that are inconceivable, like swallowing a forest fire or killing a huge python, they look at it for a few minutes and they say, "Wow, that was amazing." And then they kind of go back to their loving relationship with him, appreciating him as their best friend. So the sense of inconceivable potency is suppressed by love for Krishna in Vraj. And in our initial approach to Krishna, when we're developing a relationship with him from our vantage point of being in the material world, it's helpful for us to understand who he is and his inconceivable nature. But as the heart softens and our relationship deepens, then that becomes less important later on. And his name is Satyaraj. Steve Rosen's name is Satyaraj Das, who wrote that book. Yeah. Thank you. Excellent questions. And for all the way from the Pujari room. We always honor any inquiries from the Pujari room, and that door opens. They go first.
So, Mother, your comment really caught my attention. What really attracted me to the movement in the first place was reading Srimad Bhagavatam. I was already somewhat attracted, but it really drew me in. And as a result, in the last few months, my Guru Dev has encouraged me, you know, try to gather as many people together as you can to hear Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. So I've been brainstorming about how to do that, and your comment really caught my attention. I think this is a fantastic idea, and I would like to see if both of you could comment a little more on how you gathered the people. Are you using like an online conference room? How did you attract people to come to the, you know, call in or whatever to listen? And just a little more specifically about how that works.
Yeah, just a little background. I mean, as far as we were talking about the context of ISV, which stands for ISKCON of Silicon Valley. It also stands for independent, individual, spontaneous, and voluntary. We started in in a really simple, humble way there. A lot of the classes, there were like two people there for many years. I used to go down every Wednesday to give Bhagavad Gita class at the tiny little storefront temple we had, and sometimes two people came. But I really didn't care. I was just happy to be there, to have a forum for reading the Bhagavad Gita and studying it, and I always appreciated that there was anybody there. But as Srila Bhaktisiddhanta once said, that even if nobody shows up, you can preach to the four worlds. It's for our own purification. I think it's important to start with that premise, that it's a worthy cause unto itself to recite the Bhagavatam or the Bhagavad Gita, and even if nobody comes, it's okay. And then over long periods of time, of getting together and having classes whenever we could. Really, our community is slightly different also. Sometimes we try to apply what happens in one community and apply it universally. For many years, when people saw this, the success that Radhanath Maharaj had in Chopadi, they would say, yeah, let's just do everything that the Chopadi does. And then they try and it didn't work the way it did in Chopadi. Is because the circumstances are different. First of all, they had Radhanath Maharaj there all the time, which makes a big difference. And they also had, every situation is unique. And so you have to look at each situation, and instead of trying to apply the exact details, but apply the principles. So one of the principles is that if you make it a priority to hear and chant and you keep the vibration going, then eventually the people who are there will develop a taste for it, and that will spread. And also in our community, because nobody lives in the temple, everybody lives outside. It's always been like that. Therefore, we really emphasize the Panchanga Bhakti. This idea that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave, out of 64 items of devotional service, 5 are particularly important. And he said that even if you have a little connection with them, even if you don't have faith in them, they'll be the participants will be successful. So we've always worked with that premise that although the devotees live far away, to come all the way to the temple to participate takes a great endeavor. Many of them have children and so forth. But we felt that if on some consistent basis we had hearing and chanting, then it would be successful. And that's one of the reasons we have longer classes. We don't have classes every single day, like you do here. On Wednesday nights, we have a 2-hour class. Saturday morning, we have a 2.5-hour class. Our Sunday feast lecture is 2 hours. But so we get together when we can. Of course, we have other times also. So that's something to keep in mind. The other thing, as far as using technology goes, we've taken to live streaming on Facebook, so people can join there. And we also have our own channel on ISKCON of Silicon Valley. So whenever we have an event, it gets live broadcast right from the website. And then we also make a phone bridge. So we do all those things simultaneously. So some people who want to can join on the phone. Some people can join the live broadcast. And then there's a feature for these phone bridges conference calls where you can put people in a queue at the end, and then they can, one by one, without interrupting each other, come on and give their reflections. And it's good to have a moderator besides the person who's reading to take care of all that so that you don't have to think about it. And you can organize like that. And we do get people that join in from all over the world. It's not just the local community. People hear about it and say, hey, can I get on the call? And it creates a nice atmosphere in that way. So you can try that. It's helpful for people because they don't have to move all the way to a certain physical location to participate. And when we built our new temple, our conception was that the temple itself would be catering to a live studio audience, but the main audience was outside on the internet. That's why if you open the walls at ISV, you'll find more wires per inch than in any other temple in the world. We put everything in there, fiber optics, and to every room, so that we could broadcast outward to the world. We got cameras all over the temple room so you can get from every angle. We invest in the highest technology. We spare no expense to get the highest technology, and we have people that work on it full time, not only researching what's out there, what's better, but also even during the programs, there's somebody who's running the cameras and making sure everything works. That was what I said in the beginning of class. You make the environment in the temple room so that everyone has an opportunity to see what's going on in here. For instance, in our temple room, we have one of these screens on this side of the room and on the other side. And there are projectors that protrude from the ceiling on both sides. And so no matter where you're sitting in the temple room, you can see on the screen what's going on. And then somebody's sitting in the booth, and then as the speaker is presenting, that person is bringing up what the verses are. And if somebody quotes a verse, then they immediately put that verse up so all the devotees can see it and follow along. So these kinds of, if you put a little thoughtfulness into it and try to organize things and always make little improvements like that, then people notice it. They see that the environment's becoming more friendly for hearing and chanting. You know, little things like, last night I was, I didn't know that there were students coming. And I was wondering, who are all these young people who seem to know what's going on? And then we jumped up to chant the Brahma Samhita, and I noticed that some of them felt a little bit left out because they didn't have it. And we were chanting the Brahma Samhita. And so little things like that can add up for people, that they feel left out for a few minutes, or you know, others are doing something, they're not able to do it. Then that can actually be a hindrance. So that's why I was saying you have to figure out how to fill in all those blanks to make sure there's no gaps for people. For instance, one of my pet peeves always in the morning programs for Tulsi, for some reason there's never a copy of the, when we say the prayers of Tulsi Devi in English. Everyone just, who knows it, just says it, and everyone else who doesn't either stands there or tries to imitate. But why not have it available so everybody can read it together and memorize it? And things like that. Also, I know oftentimes when you're doing a ritual every day, for instance, you recite the 10 offenses together, it can become so rote that you don't even notice what you're saying. So when we do it at ISV or wherever else I do it, wherever I have control over the morning program, I always stop and ask people, what does this one mean? What's number three? Somebody say what the third offense means. Or sometimes you could say them backwards. My father worked in repertory theater for some time when he was in college, and he told me that the director of the theater was very much aware that when you do the same play over and over again, you start, it's noticeable that you're not that into it anymore because you're just saying your lines. And so the director would send the actors out off cue. They'd come from the wrong side of the stage, or they'd say a line when they weren't supposed to, and everybody knew that was going to happen every day. It would throw all the actors into it, will put them in a higher state of alert that anything could happen. So that's another thing I think is important in repertory, anything that's repertory. If you're going to do a ritual every single day, then you have to study it more closely. That's one thing. Like, what do the prayers actually mean? And not just assume that just because you're saying them that it's going to have the full effect. That's a niyamagraha. If you do things and then you don't consider what effect it's having or what it actually deeply means, or if you're not saying it with feeling, that's also niyamagraha. So it's one of the basic principles of the devotional community that you have to be thinking about those things, how to close those gaps and make sure there's no niyamagraha. And then it becomes naturally attractive to people, that environment. It's less predictable and less rote, and a little more stimulation, including audience participation. One of the things that we've noticed is that oftentimes people take for granted that there's some people that are advanced and some people that aren't advanced. But when you start calling on all kinds of people, the person who's silent sitting in the back, and everyone thinks, oh, you know, they're a new person, they don't know anything. And all of a sudden, they reveal the fact that they're a Paramahamsa sitting in the back there. Everyone's like, wow, there's Paramahamsa sitting back there. But, you know, it becomes more interesting to bring people out and hear their devotional personalities and the realizations come out. We'd be really surprised. Even new people have profound realizations that they can share. And that becomes interesting. And things that are interesting are compelling. Everyone wants, people are more interested in participating in those kinds of things. You better stop me. I'll keep going. Don't tempt me. Any last points? Yes? You had your hand up earlier.
Hi, Hare Krishna, thank you for the class. So by the Vaishnava service, one revives his original position, Haridas Thakura, he was the, his position in the spiritual world, I don't remember it now, but like, to the Vaishnava service, he like, remember it by Krishna's mercy, but you know, are there like symptoms or something, or how does one is knowing when he's getting near to his original position, like in the spiritual sky?
You tell me what he said.
He's basically asking that when one's on the process of devotional service, there's other great devotees who, you know, they had a really exalted position in the spiritual world, and then after a certain time, they became aware of it. So he's asking, how do we become aware? What are the symptoms that we're starting to become aware of our original spiritual position?
Well, one thing Prabhupada mentions in the Adi Lila, chapter 4, text number 34, second to last purport, is that if you're intensely hearing and chanting, and then you become attracted to hearing in a particular way, he said this can be an indication of your relationship with Krishna. Of course, it's dangerous bringing such things up because sometimes people jump the gun and try to take advantage of that and prematurely decide that they have a relationship with Krishna. But this is something Prabhupada writes in the Adi Lila as an indication. But the main indicators for those who are beginning on the path of devotional service are that one becomes disinterested in material life. This is a sure bet. If you're progressively and noticeably to yourself becoming less interested in material sense gratification, it's just not a thing anymore. It's not calling to you. Like people catch a little raccoon out in the wild. They mean, come here, fella, come here, come here. They catch him, they bring him back to their house, they start feeding him cat food or whatever they give raccoons to keep him there. And then raccoon stays there and he's like, hey, he's tame. And the next time they're sitting on the porch together, some wild raccoon calls from the wild and the little pet just says, see you later, bub, and he jumps off the porch and runs back into the wild. As if that's happening in your mind and heart, that you're, you know, you're here, you're practicing, and all of a sudden you hear the call of the wild and go, I gotta go. That's a sure sign that you're not advancing. But if you hear the call of the wild, and then you're like, you know, no thanks. I got my my master here, and I like my porch. If you like the temple more than you like the lights of the city and all the kinds of stuff, you'll notice it yourself. Nobody has to give you a certificate. There's two other symptoms that are mentioned by Madhvacharya that are all-pervasive, universal for any advanced devotee. One is consistency in the practice. You can see if somebody's consistent in their practice, they always show up, they always do their thing, that's a sure sign that they're internally advanced. And the second is what they say. You can really judge a person, Madhvacharya says, by with the words that come out of their mouth. Are they consistently merciful and helpful to others? He says it's mukhi prasadad. It means prasadam comes out of their mouth. It's mercy that they give when they speak because that's what's in their heart. So these are universal symptoms and one can see within oneself. And If you're attracted to devotees and devotee association and hearing and chanting and you really like it, this is also a good sign that you're on your way to the advanced stages of devotional service. Before we think of the most advanced stages, we should really try to come to nishta. And nishta means that you have a standing in devotional service. Shta, it's cognate with the word stand in English. You have a place to stand. You don't get knocked around. And there are five obstacles that prevent one from being in that position of nishta. One of them is called laya, or sleep. And that means that when you're doing your devotional practice and you'd rather be sleeping, and that's what you think of when you're practicing, this is a sign that you haven't reached nishta yet. And then there's distraction, which means that you're doing your practice, but you're distracted by other thoughts and ideas and things in your environment. And then there's a way in which if you're practicing and there's no distraction whatsoever and you're not tired in the least, you've got enough sleep, but you're just not interested in the practice. That's another obstacle to nishta. And then there's innate desires that are deep within my heart from being in the material world and listening to the call of the wild for so many lifetimes that come out. They just emerge and they disturb my practice. And then finally, they're in a very similar way. The senses get attracted to their objects just automatically. That's another blockade to nishta. And if one practices, as Prabhupada's mentioning in this verse, the preliminary practices of devotional service very diligently over time, then those obstacles will diminish, opening the way to nishta, which means that one knows for oneself very clearly that I have a standing in devotional service and there's nowhere else that I want to go. This is the only place for me. And I'm staying here only. Om Tat Sat. Thank you very much, everybody, for participating in the most glorious event that's happening here in all of Denver, or Colorado for that matter, today, and that is the assemblage of the Srimad Bhagavatam class. Go Premanande Haribo! Nitai Gaura Haribo! 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 Nitai Gaura Haribo! Nitai Gaura Haribo! 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 Nitai Gaura Haribo! Chakopla Vishcha Kripasandeva Chapatitanam Pavani Bio Vaishnavi Bionamunamaha Nantakoti Vaishnavindi Kijai
Marman Natari Armarman Natari Armarman Natari Armarman Hey Natari Armarman Natari Armarman Natari Armarman Natari Armarman.